Welcome to the Global Governance Podcast, where we explore the future of governance. Each episode will look at a different global issue and how governance plays a key role in its solution. From climate change to gender equality, from corruption to peace and security, we invite experts to explore a thought-provoking game of what if and why not, positing a world in much closer international cooperation.
Kirsten Bree Carlson is Associate Professor of International Law at the Department of Social Science and Business, Roskilde University, as well as the American University of Paris. She teaches topics in law and society, global studies, international politics, and Nordic migration. Dr. Carlson is the author of the books Modeling Justice, Perfecting the Promise of International Criminal Law, published by Cambridge University Press in 2019, and the Justice Laboratory, Reconceptualizing International Law in Africa, published in 2022, and numerous other articles. She also regularly writes for The Conversation. She is co-director of the American University of Paris Justice Lab. She's also affiliated with the Center for War Studies at the University of Denmark. Thank you, Kirsten, if I may, for speaking to us today. We're very pleased that you could join us for this podcast. I would like to begin our conversation by introducing your book, The Justice Laboratory, published in 2022. In the book, you observe that in recent years, international criminal justice bodies have received scrutiny from countries worldwide, including the United States, the European Union, China, Russia, and so on. And you also analyze the work of various international criminal justice institutions in sub-Saharan Africa and argue that each one of these bodies, whether it be the International Criminal Court or the UN's Rwanda Tribunal, have perhaps been too overly concerned with the political dimension of the administration of justice and have sometimes lacked, you know, what we call the capacity for the law to speak truth to power, which I think we both agree is a very important principle. For our listeners, can you describe this phenomenon and the impact it has had on international legal institutions in delivering justice worldwide?
So I want to first say thank you very much for inviting me. I'm so pleased to be here and to be able to speak about my work. And so to sort of answer your first question, I think this phenomenon, this movement of international criminal justice, this worldwide phenomenon, is really rooted in the role that it's imagined courts might be able to play as a kind of counterweight to politics. So if we think of politics as being something which in places where there's democracy and democratically elected governments is representative of at least a majority of people's interest, and in other places may be representative of a minority of people's interest, that still leaves aside the kinds of minority rights that we often imagine that courts can protect. And those minority rights could be, they're often human rights, or they could simply be politically unpopular rights. So again, if we think of democracies working, or most political places working based on a focus on what a majority wants, then there is a question of how you can constrain this absolute power. And there, that's where courts can come in. So when we look at the international criminal justice movement globally, we're often expecting that international courts can somehow constrain the power of states, of state actors, of politicians, and that constraint can happen along a series of axes that we all agree upon. So those, in the case of international criminal justice, are the core crimes that are recognized. So that's genocide, crimes against humanity, war crimes, and now what's been recognized by the International Court, although it's still a minority of countries, the notion of the crime of aggression. It's being talked a lot right now in relationship to Russia. So there's this universal agreement that those kind of activities are never legal. They can never be permitted. There's nothing that could justify them. There's no political argument for them. So in most other, in most other areas, we can sometimes imagine, well, like, you know, sometimes you have to, we can recognize there's certain rights. We have a right to speech, but sometimes we need to require silence for reasons of state security, or maybe some speech is harmful or hateful, so we can compress that right. But here, international justice is really addressing rights that we never expect to somehow to be violated. We can say that these are core rights. And so when we turn to courts, imagine courts can do something. This is because courts are seen as the kind of counterweight to political power that can hold parties to their principles, with ideas that they, or governments to their principles, ideas that they might have articulated that seem like something they could believe in, but maybe in the moment or based on a series of things that are happening, they don't want to uphold. So that's the power of the international criminal justice movement. It's an insistence on a rule of law. It's the insistence on a set of rules that are created prior to a set of judgments. So the standard kind of no backward-looking law kind of ideas. And that's where I think a lot of these ideas come from. Then, of course, we also have some experience with some successful court constraints. So we can point to examples. I think this is particularly true in Europe. We can point, and probably also in the United States as well, but there it's more in our own domestic body. But in Europe, we can point to supranational courts, so courts that exist outside of the political body that have actually made a difference for how European countries govern internally and what kind of relationship they have with other countries. So in Europe, we have a pretty long, you know, a 40 or 50 year long history of actually asking courts to demand that states adhere to the principled stances that they've taken, even when it's politically not in their interest. And that's a very powerful movement. Of course, there's another side. Obviously, courts are not democratic. No one elects judges. So it's not that everything is all, give it to the courts and everything else will work. But the power of the international justice movement is the power of providing a separate power base outside of the purely political, which is outside of the purely self-interested, within which people can agitate for rights and demand that principles that are articulated that should be transparently provided maybe can be provided. I think that's the power of the movement. Does that answer the question?
Yes. Yes. Thank you very much. That's very interesting. It's certainly a very, very interesting dimension. I want to discuss your analysis of the interplay between the International Criminal Court on the one hand and African states. You argue in your book that the ICC, the International Criminal Court, has lost some support in the region due to the perception that the organization in some way reflects aspects of neocolonialism. I don't know whether this is a fair or not a fair perception, but it seems to be there, and that it has done little to go after corrupt politicians, that it has sometimes failed to effectively prosecute violators of human rights, and so on. You're familiar with the critique. Can you share with us what are some of the factors that might have undermined support for the court in Africa? Perhaps giving us a few examples, if you can. Can international criminal justice institutions remain broadly apolitical bodies? You seem to say in your previous answer that certainly was the ideal. And if some of the criticism of the ICC in Africa is justified, you know, how can the court reclaim its reputation in the region?
Yeah, thanks. That's a really interesting question. So I think there are sort of two directions to go to answer that question. And the first has to do with what the ICC has done in Africa. So it's actual work in Africa. So those are a series of things we can look at and we can judge that work. And there in my book, in the first chapter, I try and do some of that work, right? I take us through some of those stories. But then there's a second answer, which I don't address in the book, but which I think is also a necessary answer, which is what the ICC hasn't done. And there that might have to do with the interest the ICC hasn't pursued. So something I've written about on a blog post for the conversation was an attempt to use the ICC to look at migration policy in Europe, for example, the use of the Mediterranean as a hard border that keeps migrants out of Europe, and to see that as a crime against humanity. And those attempts have not had any success. So I think that there's really this sort of two-prong consideration. There's the ICC's work in Africa and whether or not it meets the principles that the court has articulated. And then, of course, there's also the capacity to use that court to hold ourselves to account, which I just said. Now, in terms of the ICC's work in Africa, a number of people who look at the court have sort of coalesced around this idea that the court only prosecutes rebels. And this is something you hear in a number of different places and a number of different critiques. So it becomes, in that sense, one more arm of the state. And of course, at some level, this makes some sense. States become members of the ICC. States are also the most significant protectors of human rights for any of their citizens, for any individuals. You always start with the state. So on the one hand, it makes good sense that states would have some advantages when it comes to how it is that cases are heard by the ICC. On the other hand, state leaders do not have clean hands. And in a lot of these conflicts where the ICC is prosecuting rebel leaders, state leaders can absolutely be connected to atrocities. So one big example is Uganda's Museveni. Like, that is someone who has stood shoulder to shoulder with the first ICC prosecutor. But all prosecutions in Uganda have all been against rebels, people who are fighting against Museveni, and his own atrocities, the crimes with which he's associated, those have not been, they might have been investigated, but they've certainly never, no indictments have been brought, no formal investigations have proceeded at the level of the ICC. Now, one of the rationales the court gives for this, because of course the court is aware of this critique, and this is a very powerful critique of the court, right? If the court is somehow acting as one more arm of state power, then it would seem to really abdicate its role as a justice institution and all of the things that international criminal law is supposed to do in terms of recognizing and protecting victims and deterring future crimes, et cetera. So that's a very big critique. And the court's answer to this is that international criminal law is humanist in its perspective. So what international criminal law does, and that's the kind of law that the ICC is practicing, what international criminal law does is it recognizes atrocity crimes and it doesn't ask, who is this against who did this? Rather, it seeks to define the crime and address the crime. So in the short term, the court's answer is, like, maybe we'll get there. Like, eventually we have limited resources. We take these crimes. These are bad crimes that these rebel groups have done, and this and recognizing these actions as criminal is important for advancing international criminal law and making the field stronger. And in that sense, it doesn't matter who does them, so long as we recognize that these atrocity crimes are impermissible and can result in prosecution and jail time for the perpetrators of them. Of course, from another perspective, it looks very politicized, right? So then it starts to look like a kind of protectionism, or that some actors are preferred. And again, this is something where international criminal law pushes back against that entire structure of politicizing defendants. And here's a place where international criminal law really differs from domestic criminal law. Because domestic criminal law can go ahead and say that all sorts of a certain kind of crime are impermissible. All murders will be heard by the courts, and no murders will be let go. There are no murders that can simply be accepted. When there's a murder, there'll be an investigation, and when there's a perpetrator who's been identified, they will be tried, bar none. But of course, international criminal law does not work that way, cannot work that way, will never work that way. No part of international criminal law ever promises that all violations of international criminal law will be prosecuted by the ICC, certainly. The ICC's big hope is that it sets as a paradigm a set of rules that then states take upon themselves, and then states prosecute atrocities when they happen. So again, the first ICC prosecutor is sort of on record saying the court will be successful when it stands empty, when there's no one here. And of course, we would love to imagine a world where there are no atrocity crimes. That's quite possibly quite unrealistic. So instead, that's a vision that imagines that the paradigm of international criminal law, with the ICC set up as a kind of referee over the system, is such that member states and the whole world as a member state, member states address their own atrocity crimes internally.
That's a very important clarification. Thank you for that. I wanted to discuss with you something that you refer to as sort of judicial creativity in the East African Court of Justice. The way you lay out the situation is you say that this court has traditionally been a trade court, but that I guess gradually it has established a human rights jurisprudence as well. And you mentioned that the court has been very successful in prosecuting violations of the rule of law and poor governance, to the point where today, you know, some 90% of its cases concern issues of human rights. Now, you explained that this particular court has seen this success due to two major advantages over the African Court of Human and People's Rights: the absence of exhausting local remedies and a somewhat more reduced role for the state in approaching the court. Can you elaborate a little bit on these advantages and how they increase the viability and accessibility to the international criminal justice system as compared to other bodies? Do you think that a larger international legal institution should adopt elements of this East African court to increase their effectiveness?
Thanks. That's, again, a really interesting question. And I feel I shouldn't opine on how necessarily it should be done. But one thing you see in the East African Court of Justice, this trade court, as opposed to the actual human rights court that serves Africa, the African Court of Human and People's Rights, is that latter court, the human rights court, only functions once, or is only allowed to function for individuals whose states have signed a protocol agreeing to allow individuals to approach the court. So again, we come back a little bit to what's the purpose of a human rights court. So human rights courts, like the court that we have in Europe, which has been by many measures extraordinarily successful, and we can critique it in various ways, but it's a very busy court. It serves 800 million Europeans. It's not the EU court. It's bigger. It's broader than that, the Council of Europe. And it has hundreds of thousands of cases before it. Again, there are certainly valid critiques that can be made of that court. But one of the things that court does is it provides the supranational space for European citizens who feel that their state has violated their rights to bring a case and to contest that violation. So in order to work in that way, individuals need to be able to approach the court. And there's two ways to approach the court. So the first is, in the European context, you have to exhaust your domestic remedies. That means you have to try everything you can in your home state to have your case heard. Now, of course, sometimes states will decide to delay. Like, one way to stop cases from going forward is to do something internally that doesn't let them get finalized, but also doesn't decide them. And at least the European Court of Human Rights can manage that. And in kind of extraordinary circumstances, it can recognize that a state effectively has finished, something has concluded, domestic remedies have been exhausted when a state is unwilling to address a case. So the court can kind of, or has in certain instances, seen past that. But again, there's a lot of validity in saying that citizens need to exhaust their domestic remedies. You can't just be angry and instead of, you know, taking the problem to the person who's made you mad, you know, you go straight to the parent, you know, you go straight above, you go to the highest authority. That would be exhausting and impractical. And then also not allow states the role that courts imagine for them, which is to address these principled ideas on their own through their own jurisprudence and to develop their jurisprudence. And that's something that I think is a big part of the valuable role that supranational courts can play. Well, we have some ideas. We have some ways of looking at this juridically. Those also change over time. None of these things are static. But then you allow states domestically to have that conversation, which is really valuable and valid. But then, of course, if you don't, if you haven't signed a protocol that lets your citizens go there, then you kind of are trying to have things both ways. You get to say, sort of on an international level, yes, our state is a member of this court. No, our citizens can't go there, but we are a member of the court. We, the state, could possibly ask questions. We support the court, but our citizens can't use it to challenge our decisions. So one of the things that's really powerful, again, about the international justice movement, which incorporates both international criminal law and international human rights law, I would argue, is this capacity to use a supranational court to challenge something that's happened in your home state by an action that your state or its agents have taken against you. So that's a necessary component to what the value of a human rights court is. So I think, again, one of the things you've seen is, in the African context, many states have not permitted their citizens to go to the African Court of Human and People's Rights. And so then the East African Court of Justice, which was serving as a trade court, ended up imagining or kind of constructing a human rights jurisprudence for itself, in part because states were allowing citizens to go as part of the trade court, and then the jurisprudence was expanded. This is not an uncomplicated or just an entirely happy story, obviously. So judicial creativity goes both ways. When a court is making creative judicial decisions that you think are exciting, you wave your hands and cheer. But when the same court takes decisions that you feel are regressive or not rights respecting or problematic or shuts things down, we can be very unhappy. So I want to stress that because courts are not democratic, there is something problematic about having a court in enabling a court to govern in an important way has with it a series of problems. And when the East African Court creates this broad jurisprudence for itself, that is not an unproblematic move, but it's also an interesting move and a creative move. And what's interesting in some ways about the way that the court did it was it worked in many of the same ways that the European Court of Justice, which is the EU's court, worked when it determined that it couldn't be a court, also a trade court, for what was a trade agreement, you know, the early European Union, the European Economic Community, but that it wasn't possible to have trade in that community without a respect for human rights. So again, we can sort of see, but I think we as human rights defenders feel like we want to say only good things and maybe a little bit of word of caution, but there certainly is a history of this, of courts that feel that when one avenue has been closed, that maybe another avenue opens or is necessary.
I find it very interesting, this notion of creativity in the development of international criminal law, which takes me to the next question, because you wrote an article titled International Criminal Law and Its Paradoxes, where you introduce two such paradoxes in international law, the notions of progress on the one hand and justice on the other. You argue that the notion of progress within international law functions both as the legitimizing force and the end goal, as international law is rooted in rights recognition rather than precedent, justices must develop law to adhere to its progressive nature, you argue. However, at the same time, international law also promises to end the impunity and to move us all to a more just world, which then ends up equating the mandate of an international criminal tribunal to its justification for existence, right? So Can you describe how this interplay can undermine an institution's capacity to communicate effectively if we are operating within these two sort of at times conflicting paradoxes? One can understand that, right? Can you elaborate a little bit on these and how they can interact with the mandate of an international criminal tribunal?
Yeah, of course. And again, thanks for the question. I think in some ways you state it maybe more nicely than I did in my own article. But what that article was trying to do was to think about these two unresolvable problems that are at the heart of international criminal law, where it gets stuck a bit. And one is, as you described, this idea of progress, that instead of instead of setting out the principle of non-retroactivity, the idea that first you make a law and then you judge the law. So I can't just say, oh, well, today you're wearing blue shoes, and as everyone knows, blue shoes aren't allowed. I just said it. Instead, I have to say what's right or wrong, and then following that, we adjudicate whether or not you violated it. So that international criminal law steps away from, because it wants to make the world better. So it uses progress, the idea that we're making this better world, as its legitimating force, instead of the no crime without, or no law without, no crime without law, nullum crimen sine lege, the wonderful Latin expression that basically says retroactive application of the law is impermissible. But the second problem has to do with justice. And in some ways, I think, so the progress is a problem, but justice is also really a problem, because justice is, in many situations, it is what we domestically allow it to be. So when you look at our own legal systems, there we change our laws all the time. So if you think of, and especially with criminal law, which is what puts people in jail, it's a very baseline of what's permissible and what's impermissible. If you just look at the past 50 years and start naming for yourself all the things that used to be criminalized, which no longer are criminalized, but at the same time, start thinking about all the things that we used to permit, but we now start to criminalize, right? So I think here we can think about the movement of gay rights. We can also think about the Me Too movement, right? So in both directions, our societies have changed a lot in the last 50 years about what constitutes justice. How do we structure what's permissible and impermissible, and what we put people in jail for, because this is a very basic assault that the state makes on your liberty when it declares that something is illegal. And the justice paradox is the one that's also really problematic in international criminal law, because what is illegal? We can all get together and say, a crime's against humanity. It sounds awful. It sounds horrible. No one should permit that. But again, in the example I cited before, the European Union and many European states have gone out of their way to make it possible for migrants to only enter via the Mediterranean, where many die. Is this a crime against humanity? Can this be defined in that way? And that's something that, at the moment, the answer appears to be no, but maybe that will change. Those concepts of justice are things that change. And in international criminal law, we do not have a sort of a feedback loop where the people who are sitting in judgment also could be the ones who are judged. So one of the ways that we balance this internally in our own systems is we vote and we discuss and we talk and we make sure that we have systems set up so that one day, if you or I find ourselves before a court of law accused of a crime, that we have a sense that we'll know what that crime is, we'll know how it might be that we are guilty of it or not, like all of these things that have to do with non-retroactive legality, but also all of the defenses that might be available to us and the context in which our crime takes place will all be part of a society that's making the rules and subjecting itself to the rules. But often in international criminal law, we come late to a place where there's little context, and then certain actors look back in and decide what's permissible and impermissible. And again, with a lot of these atrocity crimes, it seems kind of black and white, like how could this ever be permitted? But I think once you start to look at how actions work in law, or in war rather, so if you take a look at the work of the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, there it is obviously criminal to participate in the genocide at Srebrenica, but it's also criminal to participate in the ethnic cleansing, which is moving people away from Srebrenica so that they're not genocided. So in both of these circumstances, your actions are criminal. So you find people who occupy certain stations who cannot not do something criminal. And that, I think, is a justice problem. That's something that we don't tend to permit in our domestic systems, but that you find a lot of in international law.
You mentioned Yugoslavia, and let me, in my next question, address one aspect of that particular case. In your book, Modeling Justice, you introduce the role of narrative and ideology regarding the effectiveness of these tribunals. And you cite the interesting case of the International Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, in which the regional discourse surrounding ethnicity sort of contributed to shape perceptions of that court. For instance, you describe how the three predominant groups, you know, the Croats, the Serbs, the Bosnians, in the former Yugoslavia, did not accept the court's liberal humanist interpretation. And in fact, you say that they have tended to reference the findings of the court only when it justifies their own, you know, recount of the events that happened at the time. So what is the importance of national discourse and cultural norms regarding the effectiveness of international criminal tribunals? I mean, this is specifically in the case of Yugoslavia, but I'm sure it has broader applicability to other settings, given the international nature of these courts. How must these tribunals incorporate regional undertakings or values, if you wish, in their findings and dissemination?
Yeah, thanks again for a great question. And this is, once again, like I think a lot of the other questions, these are not necessarily, I mean, we won't find an answer for this right now. But what I find interesting is, again, that the project of international criminal law would seek to create a liberal, humanitarian narrative that, as I was mentioning before, would recognize certain kinds of harms, certain kinds of crimes, irrespective of whom they're committed against. So it doesn't ask, who is the victim here? Is the victim someone who I feel has suffered? If this is a Hutu who beforehand was part of the group that committed a genocide against Tutsis, does the fact that this Hutu has now been targeted and killed, does that change the crime that's happened against them? And the answer that international criminal law would give to this is no. That in fact, it's essential that it's no, because the power of the discourse is to recognize the apolitical nature of these crimes. And so in a sense, when you watch these international criminal justice institutions act around the world and you see this narrative rejected by either a nationalist discourse that's only interested in outcomes or that's rendered suspect because only certain kinds of people can come before the courts. So that either has to do with how the courts work themselves or how the courts are received in the places where they're working or the places that their work is aimed towards. That is, in a sense, it's a challenge towards the narrative, the myth, the paradigm that international criminal law is seeking to present, right? This idea of a shared humanity and the impermissibility of certain kinds of acts. I think of a lot about Hannah Arendt when we have these kind of discussions, right? Because Hannah Arendt is the person who reminds us that you need to be situated in a political community to have rights. And so in some ways, I think this project it follows the Second World War that Hannah Arendt was critical of. You know, will this project fix the kind of flaws that arose in the Second World War? The International Criminal Justice's answer is yes, we've solved it. If everyone can think in international humanitarian terms, so if we can think about humanity as one shared body, then we have a resolution. And Hannah Arendt was doubtful, and I think we would all like her to be wrong. I'm afraid that the work that I see with the courts demonstrates she was right.
You would probably know, because you have looked at our website, that at the Global Governance Forum, we have advocated for structural changes in legal institutions. Many of our proposals are focused on the UN, sort of broadly defined, but also the International Criminal Court, so that they are better equipped to handle, you know, the sort of evolving geopolitical landscapes and problems that we face. Most notably, we have worked very actively over the last couple of years in the campaign for the establishment of an international anti-corruption court so that we have a more effective mechanism to prosecute kleptocrats for instances of grand corruption. This campaign reflects the need to highlight certain violations of international law that perhaps are too complex to be seen in front of a traditional court like, you know, the International Criminal Court, for instance. So my question to you is, what role do you believe these specialized courts could play in advancing international justice? And in what other areas, if necessary, do you believe that an individual court could promote a greater effectiveness of international criminal law?
In fact, there is this really interesting protocol to the African Court of Human and, or, sorry, no, it's a protocol to this Malabo Court. It's called the Malabo Protocol, and it imagines a new court in addition to the African Court of Human and People's Rights, which would be also, it would deal with criminal law and human rights law. So it would put human rights and criminal law together. And one of the things that court would address is corruption. Another thing it would address is environmental crimes, right? So there are these really interesting areas that are left out of international justice institutions, certainly international criminal justice and human rights institutions that could be, that definitely have a strong, I think, principled rationale to make for being included for the reasons that you state. I think for many people, everyday corruption certainly is more meaningful and more problematic, more destructive, more violent than acts of war, because hopefully most of the globe is not actively feeling the effects of the kinds of atrocity crimes that international criminal justice is set up to address. But I guess I'm a bit of a pessimist for the reasons that I've laid out for you before, because I think that we still have these same questions about justice that end up, if not progress, because we can go ahead and define some of those crimes and set them down. But what constitutes this kind of crime? Like, in what circumstances is something permitted? When is something corruption? So you'll know, obviously, in the United States, we have a major lobbying industry, and that's controlled to a certain degree, but also it's pretty permissive in a lot of ways. So would we call that corruption? If there's an international corruption court, will that become corruption? When you make the rules about the international corruption court to try and get the United States on board, would you make sure that you define corruption in such a way that lobbyists won't be somehow roped in? So, and I think, and these end up being justice questions because they are politically constructed, right? If we're making a court, and most things are politically constructed, but then we might not be able to do the kinds of work that you're imagining. So then we also have the same problem that, as with the International Criminal Court, it's symbolically powerful because it declares that certain things are impermissible and illegal, but in fact, it has no police force. It requires that states cooperate with it. So likewise, when it comes to corruption, if you're looking at the petty corruption of police taking bribes instead of writing tickets, then maybe a court can be effective, but I don't know that you need an international court because it might also be effective to have domestic remedies. But if you're going after leadership, then you have to have leadership that's willing to be gone after and then willing to accede to the jurisdiction of the court. And one of the things that we see with international criminal justice is that often, not always, and this is, I think, one of the interesting cases of the ICC that I tell in the Justice Laboratory book, there have been some cases where leaders have actually gone ahead and turned themselves into the ICC. Oh, you want a piece of us? Absolutely. And beaten the court even that way. But for many other people, they just say, no, thank you. I don't want to participate. How are you going to get me? So I think that the larger question about the power of courts and law has to do with the norms that they can set out. So it's true that even if you had a corruption court, an international corruption court, that couldn't actually get its fingers into some of the most corrupt, let's say, leaders or politicians or the most, or private business people, right? So I think a very interesting conversation we can have about people who seem to flit above states who are more powerful than some states. That's a whole other topic. But were there such a court, even if it were not possible for it to get the cases perhaps that it was seeking to take, perhaps there'd be something very powerful in simply declaring this kind of activity to be illegal. And that's, I think, for me at least, that's a lot of the power of what international criminal law does. Again, most of the transgressors of international criminal crimes will never be dealt with either by an international court or even, sadly, by a domestic court. But there's still a normative power in recognizing that something isn't just unfortunate. It's not bad luck, or it's actually a crime, right? There's something very powerful in declaring something a crime and saying that something should not happen. So to the degree that having an international corruption court could add to that conversation about what makes good governance, what are the kinds of places that we expect to live in, how is the public interest served, right, that we can all agree on that, that might be powerful. But in terms of how it actually works, I guess I'm a bit skeptical.
You know, the thinking behind the International Anti-Corruption Court would be to address those situations where the kleptocrats control the courts, they control the prosecutors, they control the police, and therefore are able to steal with impunity, right? And therefore, there is no recourse to law within the territory where the kleptocrat happens to rule. But let me move on, Kirsten, to the last question in this podcast. It has been really fascinating, and I am very touched by your enthusiasm for the kinds of issues and questions and paradoxes that emerge as international law develops. I want to discuss the notion that you have put forward, that international law is a kind of a young discipline, right? Making experimentation of its procedures necessary for the progress of these institutions. I like that idea. I find it very appealing. I like the notion of evolution in our concepts of international law. Of course, in last couple of decades, we have witnessed a kind of a formalization of international criminal law with the establishment of the ICC. However, you can see that structural challenges continue to arise in this evolving sort of geopolitical environment. You can see that, for instance, in the context of Russia's invasion of Ukraine and the kinds of questions that are being raised in respect of the ICC, very appropriately, it seems to me. With these considerations in mind, how do you believe that jurists and advocates alike should regard calls for legal and structural changes to international criminal tribunals? What mechanisms do you believe should be established to embrace this reform? And then finally, if you could just spend your last minute saying something to young people, you know, the Global Governance Forum in social media has close to 1 million followers. And a lot of these are people in their late 20s, early 30s. And how can you what would you like to tell them in terms of encouraging to basically go down the career path that you chose some however many years ago? You know, again, I was very very touched by your enthusiasm for these questions, and you tend to frame them in a way that is very appealing, very interesting, very provocative. So let's see if in your last sentences of the podcast you can get some young people to follow in your footsteps.
Great, thanks. No pressure. But yeah, thanks. So first, in terms of reform, and I guess this in a sense, it leads into maybe the young people or how we take up this torch. I think it's always tricky to be a person who believes in human rights. I would definitely position myself as like firmly ensconced in the camp of human rights. I'm a person, I guess you could put me on the political left. And yet here I am critical of the very institutions that I should love. You know, they're certainly better than other institutions, but I think that it's particularly important for us to have this conversation. And that's why with my first book, I called it Modeling Justice, Perfecting the Promise of International Criminal Law. Like, I do find it very flawed in these principled ways that we shouldn't ignore. And maybe it's not possible to fix the flaws. There will always be balances that need to be made, but we don't gain anything by pretending that I'm a human rights defender, and this court is prosecuting atrocities rather, and so therefore everything is good. Like, that I think is problematic, and we don't do ourselves any favors. We want to ask hard questions, and we want to continue to push institutions to do better. We want to do that domestically with our own rule of law institutions, and then we want to perfect these supranational institutions so that they can, in a principled way, continue to help our domestic institutions do better. So in that sense, I guess I am this real believer in the potential of progress. So for young people, I mean, I don't know that people want to go, and I'm a law professor. I have the glory of sitting and reading things and writing my books and teaching wonderful students. I think a lot of the students I teach actually go into the world and they are working in NGOs, they're working for governments, they're working in private companies, in places where they're trying to effectuate changes themselves with an eye to notions of principled, you know, rights and progress that I think are impressive and motivating and wonderful. A lot of what I did with the Justice Laboratory was in a sense built on my concern that for many people not trained in law, that they ignore the law part. And that I think is a mistake and shouldn't be done. Like, law is text. You can read, once you speak a language, you can read the laws written in the language. You can, in most parts of the world, with the exception of the United States and England and Australia, with the exception of common law countries, you can just read, open a code and have some idea of what is permissible and impermissible. And with international legal judgments, as long as you have the internet, you have access to almost all of those written in English or French, and then often in other languages. So there's a transparency to these set of arguments that can be found in law by reading legal judgments, by looking at what courts do, that I think is too often left to lawyers as if it's too specialized. And that would be what I would encourage young people to do. I'm not saying go to law school, do that if you want, but whether or not you've gone to law school, don't ignore the legal part, because these decisions are written in a text that you can understand, and they often contain principles and arguments that you want to engage with. Like, these courts are often putting out ideas or making their own principled stances in the world that are ones that we can all engage in. And so I would suggest that people keep working towards reading and understanding and having those conversations.
Thank you for listening to the Global Governance Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with friends and family. To learn more, please visit globalgovernanceforum.org and join the conversation. Thank you.